Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and today I'll be talking about some presentations that were shown at the American College of Rheumatology, or ACR. This year, it was, of course, virtual due to the pandemic, and it's called the ACR Convergence Meeting 2020, and it was held November 5th through 9th. Enjoy listening. There was a presentation by Dr. Elizabeth Park from Columbia University Irving Medical Center in the U.S. looking at 681 patients with rheumatoid arthritis and systemic lupus erythematosus. And she really described how hydroxychloroquine use in those patients, in that cohort of rheumatic patients, might be associated or not associated with arrhythmias in those patients. So hydroxychloroquine plays an essential role in the management of both systemic lupus erythematosus and as well as the management of rheumatoid arthritis, both as a monotherapy and in combination with other disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, so DMARDs. However, there's been an ongoing concern regarding its cardiovascular safety in these patients, and recently the interest increased because of an observational study of COVID-19 patients reporting that 19% of those receiving hydroxychloroquine demonstrated a QTc measure of greater than 500 milliseconds, including a single torsades de pointe tachycardia. So, quote, given recent concerns surrounding hydroxychloroquine use in COVID-19 patients and subsequent arrhythmic events, we wanted to examine the associations between its use and the QTc length on electrocardiograms in a large asymptomatic cohort of rheumatoid arthritis and lupus patients, said Dr. Park in her talk. So for this purpose, the researchers assessed the QTc length and its association with hydroxychloroquine use in a large lupus and rheumatoid arthritis cohort. The cross-sectional study analyzed the data of 681 patients, as I previously said, without clinical cardiovascular disease and including two prospective rheumatoid arthritis cohorts of 307 patients and a retrospective lupus cohort of 374 patients. So in the two prospective rheumatoid arthritis cohorts, the ECGs were performed as part of a study data collection, whereas in the single retrospective lupus cohort, the 374 patients, ECGs were performed as part of their standard of care. The researchers explored the association between QTc length and hydroxychloroquine use by these patients, and they adjusted the data for disease-specific characteristics and cardiovascular disease risk factors. If you look at the whole study group, so both rheumatoid arthritis and lupus patients, 54% used hydroxychloroquine and 44% had QTc lengths of more than 440 milliseconds. The mean QTc length was 437 plus or minus 28 milliseconds. However, in the entire cohort, adjusted QT length among the hydroxychloroquine users was comparable to those who did not use the drug. So in multivariate logistic modeling, hydroxychloroquine use was not a significant predictor of a prolonged QTc. And that was both true for both rheumatoid arthritis and the lupus cohorts. However, 9 out of the 11 lupus patients who did have a prolonged QTc were taking hydroxychloroquine, yet these observations were actually too small to detect statistically significant differences between the two groups. The study also did not find any significant interactions between hydroxychloroquine and other QTc prolonging drugs in the patients. Hydroxychloroquine use combined with other QTc prolonging medications resulted in a comparable QTc interval to hydroxychloroquine alone. So in the lupus group, the hydroxychloroquine combined with antipsychotic drugs did result in a longer QTc compared with just using hydroxychloroquine alone. And so that went from 441 milliseconds versus 432 milliseconds, and that was a p-value of 0.014, so pretty significant. So Dr. Park concluded, quote, overall, the use of hydroxychloroquine did not predict QTc length, even while adjusting for critical confounding factors, namely the use of other QTc prolonging medications. Our findings reinforce the fact that hydroxychloroquine remains a safe, effective, long-term disease-modifying drug to our rheumatic disease patients. One of the late-breaking abstracts that was presented by Professor Philip Meese of the University of Washington in the U.S. Was about a phase 2 study of deucravacitinib in psoriatic arthritis patients. Now, the thing about deucravacitinib that people have been sort of excited about is that it's a novel oral tyrosine kinase inhibitor against the JAK family TYK2. And the idea behind this is that you can fairly specifically inhibit TYK2, and in doing such, also sort of specifically target interleukin-23. And we know that interleukin-23 inhibition is very effective in psoriatic diseases. And so the idea, the hope, I guess, is that this would be very effective as an oral approach to IL-23 inhibition that was fairly specific and with a good safety profile. So this is a phase 2 study of deucravacitinib. And it's, like I said, it's pretty selective compared to other drugs in this class, and it doesn't bind to the kinase domain, so that's also a plus about this particular small molecule inhibitor. It inhibits downstream pathways important in psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis pathophysiology. And in earlier phase 2 dose-finding studies in psoriasis, this drug had shown to be significantly more effective compared with placebo. And 67 to 75% of the patients treated with at least 3 milligrams of deucravacitinib achieved a greater than 75% reduction from their baseline PASI score at 12 weeks. And only 7% of the placebo arm reached that. So that was obviously highly significant with only mild to moderate adverse events. So very promising in that respect. In the trial that was being presented during the ACR, the efficacy and safety of the selective TYK2 inhibitor, deucravacitinib, was evaluated in patients with active psoriatic arthritis, and results from the initial 16-week placebo-controlled phase were presented. So the 16 weeks of treatment were completed by 180 of the 203 patients enrolled, so that's an 89% completion rate, and the baseline characteristics were comparable between both groups. An adequate response to TNF inhibitors was observed in 15% of patients, but both deucravacitinib at 6 and 12 milligrams demonstrated significantly greater ACR20 responses, so that was the primary endpoint, versus placebo. And that was 52.9% for the 6 milligram arm and 62.7% in the 12 milligram arm, compared with just under 32% in the placebo arm. The selective TYK2 inhibitor was also superior regarding the ACR50 and ACR70 scores as well. And significant results were observed regardless of previous TNF inhibitor exposure or due to body weight. So in addition, functional improvements assessed in the Health Assessment Questionnaire Disability Index were significantly more pronounced in both the deucravacitinib doses compared to the placebo. Moreover, the treatment led to an increased quality of life and a resolution of enthesitis, which, well, psoriasis-related and composite outcomes were improved versus placebo. So in general, the treatment was really well tolerated, and I think that that might be the distinguishing factor of this drug compared to other IL-23. I think the efficacy and functional data were pretty similar to other drugs that we've seen out there, but the safety profile for an oral small molecule inhibitor was quite favorable in this case. And Professor Meese concluded with the quote, "And these results suggest that deucravacitinib may be a promising treatment for patients with active psoriatic arthritis and support its continued clinical development for this disease." I think just from my personal view, I do have to question where this might fit in the algorithm, the treatment algorithms are there, because we have so many excellent drugs at this point to approach psoriatic diseases. And I think the distinguishing factor here might be the safety, and I'm looking forward to more complete safety data with that regard. Dr. Priyanka Balal from Boston University Medical Center in the U.S. Talked about the risk of knee and hip replacement and how it might be related or linked to vitamin K antagonist use. So in patients with osteoarthritis, this study was looking at the effect of vitamin K antagonist, warfarin specifically, and how that would be associated with a significantly increased risk of joint replacement. So Dr. Balal pointed out that vitamin K not only plays a role in the coagulation, but that several proteins in the bone and cartilage depend on it as well. And she said, quote, "Inadequate levels of vitamin K have been shown to cause abnormal joint tissue mineralization and contribute to the incidence of osteoarthritis." End quote. The current study that she presented aimed to find out if antagonizing vitamin K by warfarin would increase osteoarthritis progression. So using data from the Health Improvement Network, a nested case control study was performed that included 913 patients with knee and hip replacements. These patients were matched by age and gender to 3,652 controls. It was a UK database and it contained medical records from the general practitioners, and it's representative of the general population. The sample existed of adults of 40 to 80 years of age between 2009 and 2018 who were treated with warfarin or direct oral anticoagulant Stoax for atrial fibrillation. Among the exclusion criteria were severe comorbidities, restricting surgery, knee replacement or hip replacement before 2014, and warfarin or DOAC use within 1 year before the study. By performing a conditional logistic regression, results were controlled for confounders. The mean age of the study subjects was 75.1 years, and 48% were female. And warfarin was given to 64.8% of the cases, while 35.1% received DOACs. Among the controls, the rate of warfarin users was 56.3% and 43.6% for the DOACs. The results showed that the confounder-adjusted risk for knee replacement or hip replacement was 57% higher in the warfarin-treated patients, with an adjusted odds ratio of 1.57. Compared to DOAC intake, drug exposure to warfarin augmented the risk over time, and a higher risk was still significant in further adjusted analyses that accounted for other reasons for hip replacement than osteoarthritis. We then assessed, quote, she said, Dr. Bilal, we then assessed for duration of warfarin use to DOAC use, and we found an incremental risk of hip replacement and knee replacement within the duration of warfarin use. In those with warfarin use over 4 years, the risk requiring hip replacement or knee replacement was actually twofold. So Dr. Bilal concluded, quote, our study implies that given the prevalence and impact of osteoarthritis, our data along with the existing literature support the need for a well-powered randomized controlled trial for evaluating vitamin K supplementation in osteoarthritis, and our study also raises the consideration of using DOACs over warfarin when indicated in people with or at risk of osteoarthritis. Very interesting study. Some good news for patients with active ankylosing spondylitis was presented by Professor Deodar, Atul Deodar from the Oregon Health and Science University in the U.S. This was a phase 3 interim data, and it was looking at the JAK inhibitor tofacitinib in patients with active ankylosing spondylitis. So although tofacitinib has already been approved for rheumatoid arthritis and psoriatic arthritis, this JAK inhibitor tofacitinib, it's now being tested in the phase 3 trial for ankylosing spondylitis, and it's a randomized placebo-controlled double-blinded study and including 269 adult patients. So diagnosis was confirmed by meeting the modified New York criteria and centrally read x-rays, and patients had not responded previously to treatment with at least two other drugs. So over 16 weeks, the study subjects received either 5 milligrams tofacitinib twice daily or a placebo. And in the following open-label extension, all patients received 5 milligrams tofacitinib twice daily until week 48. The primary endpoint was defined as assessment in ankylosing spondylitis, so the ASAS 20 response, at week 16. The key secondary endpoint was ASAS 40 achievement. In addition, four groups of endpoints for efficacy were evaluated at week 16, including a change in various outcome types. Safety data was available up to week 48. So Dr. Deodar said, quote, the majority of patients, 80%, were naive to biological DMARDs, and 20% were inadequate responders to TNF inhibitors or had experienced biological DMARDs in the past. Baseline criteria included about 85% males, and the average age was 41. The symptom duration was about 13 years, and the ankylosing spondylitis disease activity score, the ASDAS, was 3.8 for the group receiving tofacitinib and 3.9 for the group receiving placebo. The rate of patients achieving ASAS 20 response was 56.4% with tofacitinib and 29.4% with placebo, and of course that's a significant number. The percentage of ASAS 40 responding patients was significantly higher in those treated with tofacitinib, 40.6%, than those receiving placebo, only 12.5%. The ASDAS was significantly reduced by -1.36 for tofacitinib versus -0.39 for placebo, again significant. Comparisons for the ASAS components as well as other secondary endpoints, including CRP reduction, were all significantly in favor of tofacitinib treatment. With regard to safety, up to week 16, adverse events were registered for 54.1% in the tofacitinib and 51.5% in the placebo group, with serious adverse event rates of 1.5% and 0%, respectively. Study discontinuation due to adverse events at week 16 was low, however, so only 2.3% in the tofacitinib group and 0.7% in the placebo. There were no unexpected side effects. And concerning safety up to week 48, it was important to draw our attention, said Dr. or Professor Deodar, to the fact that there were no malignancies, no thromboembolic events, and no major adverse cardiac events or gastrointestinal perforation events. So in conclusion, this study did meet its primary and secondary endpoints. Exciting data for the patients with this horrific disease, and its demonstration of significant superiority over placebo for the treatment of active ankylosing spondylitis. One question that's absolutely necessary to answer is whether rheumatic patients actually have an increased risk for COVID-19 serious outcomes. So one study presented by Dr. Naomi Serling Boyd from the Massachusetts General Hospital in the U.S. Looked at the risk for rheumatic patients that have had COVID-19. So she started off by saying, quote, "Early in the pandemic, we observed a higher risk of mechanical ventilation in patients with rheumatic diseases compared with the general population in a very small cohort study," end quote. But the situation is still not really clear, and rheumatologists and their patients are concerned about potential risks. And this has encouraged the investigators to further research the initial study. And so they conducted a comparative cohort study of patients with COVID-19 as confirmed by PCR between January and July 2020 in a multi-center healthcare system. So out of 12,866 COVID-19 cases during that period, 143 of those patients were diagnosed with a rheumatic disease, and they were matched by age, sex, and date of COVID-19 PCR data positivity with up to five comparators without rheumatic disease, and there were 688 of those in that. So within this, the rheumatic disease group, the mean age was 60 years, and 76% of the patients were female. 52% were never smokers, and the median Charlson comorbidity index equaled 2. The corresponding features in the non-rheumatic disease group were mean age of 59, 76% were female, and 50% were never smokers, and they had a Charlson comorbidity index of 0. The most common rheumatic diagnosis was rheumatoid arthritis, so that was 31% of the patients, lupus at 19%, and the rheumatic patients had ongoing treatments with corticosteroids, so 36% of them, hydroxychloroquine, 21% of them, and conventional synthetic DMARDs at 31% of them, and biologic DMARDs, 29% of them. The adjusted results of a Cox proportional hazard model indicated a higher risk only for mechanical ventilation with a hazard ratio of 1.75. But after adjustment for race, smoking, and the comorbidities, the increased risk no longer had any significance, and with a hazard ratio of 1.51. Hence, so it's thought that both our rheumatic diseases and non-rheumatic diseases have a similar outcome risk for COVID-19. And these findings provide reassurance for rheumatic disease patients. So it seems like we need to continue close monitoring of patients with other comorbidities, but it doesn't seem that having rheumatic disease in particular warrants special concerns. Thanks for listening to this podcast covering the ACR Convergence abstracts. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and I wish you a fine day and stay safe.